Welcome to PCMC. I'm Mike Bongiorno. This is Pop Culture Man Children. That's what the kids on the street call PCMC. I talk to the kids on the street and they say, hey, PC, you want to buy some PCMC? And I don't know what they're talking about. I'm here today with my good friend and yours, Mr. Peter Marsh.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
You know, Pete from the LasherCast and Comic Books Transformed. And here he is again today on PCMC. Pete, you were just saying something that was interesting. We were talking before we were on air. We were talking about the new Ghostbusters and the new Godzilla versus Kong, or Godzilla times Kong. which reminds me of Alien 3 is Alien Cubed. It's Alien times Alien times Alien. I always say, like, this podcast is your one-stop shop for non-toxic fandom. But I want to say, like, I want to make it clear to people what I mean by that is not, it's not that we're like, we like everything. It's not like everything's four stars.
Yeah.
Because that would be pointless. We criticize things. We make fun of things. We talk about how things are bad. To me, that's part of the love of media. You know, like, I just did, my last episode was on Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. And I talked about what I liked and what I didn't like. And, you know, yesterday I went to see Godzilla vs. Kong, times Kong, with Jen. And while, like, I guess the first fight between King Kong, when King Kong, like, had, like, he needed a root canal, I looked at Jen and I was like, thanks for coming to this stupid movie with me.
Yeah.
But I still love it. So what I mean, here's what I really mean. When I say non-toxic fandom, I mean, you're never going to hear me go, you know what I don't like about this movie? There's too many Chinese people in it. Like, you're never going to hear that from me.
Yeah.
I'll say a movie's bad, or I'll say, you know, we're critical. Criticism is part of the love. Like, when a new Star Wars movie comes out, I feel like every conversation I have with one of my friends is like, what did you hate? What did you love? How would you rewrite it yourself? Right? And right. That's part of it. That's, to me, that's part of the overall, like, good part of fandom. I'm not saying, like, there shouldn't be criticism. It's just, to me, toxicity is like, hey, you know what we should do? I really hated the new Kong movie. Let's find the actress in the movie and just, like, destroy her on Twitter. Let's say we're gonna, like, call her the C word. That'd be a fun way to exercise our fandom. That's what I mean.
No, I get it, man. I get it. And as, like, a guy that has YouTube channels and a podcast, you know, you see all the views that you get on YouTube. You see all the listens you get on your podcast. And I know for a fact that because me and Brian, or me and Danny, often speak positively about these movies, that, like, that affects how many views we get. Like, it seems like YouTube in general is made, like, or the way it's become is that if you are, like, passionately mad about something, that's when you're going to get the most views.
Yeah.
You know, like, you and I talk about Star Wars, like, so much every time I come on your show. And, like, there's this one dude, his name's Star Wars Theory. Have you ever seen any of his videos?
Yeah.
That dude, it's like he kind of embodies that, like, okay, oh, I hate woke Disney and I hate,
Kathleen,
you know,
Kennedy is the worst thing ever.
Right. And so people eat that shit up. He's got millions of followers, millions of views. A lot of the times when I review something with one of my friends, it's either, hey, that was actually pretty good. But, you know, I understand the idea to criticize these things because I saw Godzilla X Kong. I saw Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. And I'm kind of critical of both of them.
Yeah.
Because I feel like they don't have that sense of wonder that the movie that we're going to talk about today has in spades.
Right. Today we're talking about a movie that I absolutely love, there are some criticisms of it, for sure. It kind of doesn't have much of a plot. It's sort of beginning, end.
right.
We're talking about Superman the movie, which now a lot of times they just call Superman, from 1978. This is the year after Star Wars, and to me that's important because I'm very obsessed about the changeover from new American cinema to blockbuster cinema. You know, new American cinema is Easy Riders and Raging Bulls and, you know, early Scorsese and that kind of, like, you know, Bonnie and Clyde, that kind of stuff. And then, like, you have the blockbuster stuff. And people always say, like, the beginning is either Jaws or Star Wars. But I feel like Superman is overlooked in that. And especially when you look at movies right now, obviously Superman is super influential for blockbuster movies going forward.
Totally, 1,000% agree. And I was thinking, on your channel, do you really cover a lot of movies that are from the 70s? Like, you mainly cover stuff that, like, you saw as a kid. And you saw this movie as a kid, obviously. But, like, it came out before your birth. Just like A New Hope came out, too.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like I've never done this study. Probably most of it are from the 80s or later.
Yeah.
But we've gone as early as like the 50s and stuff.
Oh, so very cool.
We try to get a look at everything. Since I'm talking so much about how I philosophize the show, the way I think about PCMC is not every topic has to be popular culture. Like, we do esoteric topics.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it's looking at those things through a lens of pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me, what's your history with Superman the movie?
Ah, okay. Great question. So often when I do these shows, I always talk about how, like, I see movies over and over again, or I saw movies over and over again on HBO when I was a kid. Like, I just always had HBO playing at my house, like, whenever I was at my house. And this is a movie that, like, would just always be on. You'd see clips of it over and over again. I don't think in my life I've, like, watched this movie from beginning to end many times, but I've seen, like, parts of it a ton of times. But I remember, like, seeing this as a kid, and there's, like, certain scenes when you watch it now as an adult, you're like, oh yeah, this, like, really stood out to me as a kid. This had an effect on me as a kid. This part, you know, there's a couple of parts like that in this.
Yeah. It was shown to me as a kid a few times. And when I was a little kid, I thought it was boring because I was like, unless Superman was on screen flying, I was like, not interested.
Yeah.
But then, like, in my early 20s, I became, like, I got super into Superman just as a fan. Mm-hmm. And that's when I really, like, watched it with fresh eyes and, like, really loved it. And I've watched it so many times since then. When I used to teach film, I would teach this movie. Actually, I'm going to talk later. I taught a few times a class on race, gender, and sexuality in the media. Mm-hmm. And I used to show this to talk about gender and sexuality.
Huh. Okay.
Mostly we would focus in on the "Do you like pink? I like pink very much, Lois." Scene.
Yes.
But I love it now. I mean, I just watched it again yesterday, and I don't know. I think it's got that quality of, like, even though it you know, it doesn't hold up visually the way like a Star Wars will or something.
Yeah.
I think it's gorgeous.
Oh, 1,000%. The cinematography in this movie is incredible. And it's funny because you talk about how, like, in your early 20s, you really got into Superman. You know, that's when I met you, was in your early 20s, right?
Yeah.
And you were talking about on your Ghostbusters Frozen Empire episode that, like, oh, Ghostbusters is very intimate to you. And that's why you did the episode by yourself, because it's very intimate. And to me, I was thinking that Superman was actually very intimate to you, because, like, I think you were even maybe wearing a fucking Superman t-shirt when I met you. You know,
and
we talked about Superman a lot. Like, you know, I don't know, people probably heard my voice on this show a couple of times, but, like, I'm a gigantic comic book fan, right? Mm. And I love comic books. I've read probably hundreds of comics with Superman in them, maybe thousands at this point in my life. And this movie, you could tell that this movie is the inspiration for so many writers and artists when it comes to Superman.
Yes.
You know?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. It becomes, well, there are things in the movie. The thing about the history of Superman, and this is true for a lot of pop culture, is as it continues to be adapted or readapted, people will add things to it, and the good things will stick and the bad things will fall away. Right. Like, in the beginning, Superman didn't fly. He just jumped very high. And it had nothing to do with the sun. It had to do with gravity being different on Krypton. And Kryptonite was created by the radio show. Actually created a lot. Kryptonite, mm-hmm. the Perry White character, I think maybe the Jimmy Olsen character, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Fortress of Solitude came later. You know, things got, and I think the movie adds a lot of things. The idea that the Fortress of Solitude is like crystalline, which is mm-hmm. my favorite way of thinking of the Fortress of Solitude.
Mm-hmm.
It was early, like very much like a Batcave.
Yes.
And it had like big statues of bullshit. The idea that he really is Kal-El and that he's going to play Clark is like bumbling, I think is a lot of that comes from Christopher Reeve's decisions. And that becomes a big part of, I think, Superman going forward. And even, and this might sound like a hot take, the idea that it's a love story between Lois and Clark really, I think, begins in this movie. Because in the original comic and in the early shows and radio show, Lois has a thing for Superman, but Superman is so alien, he doesn't really have a thing back for her. And a lot of the way that works itself out in the plot is Lois wanting to prove that he's Superman. It's a lot of like cat and mouse, like, I'm going to prove you're Superman. Oh, no, you're not. And then she tries to, and then she never is able to do it. In this movie, they really cement the idea, like, oh, no, this is a love story. They both like each other.
Right.
And that, you think about, like, then in the 90s, you have Lois and Clark, which is like their love story is the center of the whole thing. It just changes over time. And the good things stick with it.
Yeah, that is a really, really excellent point. Like, when I think about, like, my entire lifetime of being around, reading comics, watching, like, animated series based on DC characters, the Superman and Lois dynamic, their love is just as important as, like, Spider-Man and Mary Jane, right? And it's interesting because, like, Batman... you know, obviously Batman is always closely associated with Superman and like in movies, animation and comics. And Batman really didn't have that kind of love, that aspect until very, very recently, where it's been like him and Catwoman. But like him and Catwoman have always had a thing, and that goes all the way back to, you know, the 70s or whatever. And you know, Batman Returns shows it, obviously. But, like, they've made that more of a thing now in modern comics. And often, like, they have a kid together, the two of them. And then, like, in, you know, Golden Age and Silver Age comics, there's, like, an alternate future where Batman and Catwoman have a daughter.
Yeah.
Huntress. But there's always this idea of, like, Lois and Clark getting together. And you mentioned the show from the 90s, which is, I'm glad you did that. But then there's also a modern show called Superman and Lois. You know, so, and then I just wanted to bring up one other point too, because I don't want to forget it. Like, that was a really great job talking about like the Fortress of Solitude and stuff like that. Like, I feel like there's certain things that they don't ever rewrite that like they always keep now. And the Fortress of Solitude always does have crystals of some kind.
Yeah.
There's always crystals. It's always in the Arctic. They do have big statues and stuff in the fortress in the comics, but often in like the movies and stuff, it's just this barren kind of fortress like you see in this movie.
So what I think is kind of extraordinary about the movie is it has three sections, and each section has its own tone, and with that tone comes its own like way of its own cinematography, its own performance style. You know, you could break them down as Krypton, Smallville, Kansas, and then Metropolis. But like the tonally, like Krypton is like Greek tragedy. You know, like even the way they talk is like Shakespearean. It reminds me of Plato's cave, the idea of Plato's cave, like the person is a prisoner in the cave, and they're staring at the wall, and they're let free, and they try to come back and convince the other people in the cave that what they're seeing is not real, and they don't believe him. Like that whole scene where everyone's telling fucking Marlon Brando, Jor-El. Like, you're crazy. Be reasonable, Jor-El. Like, that's like this, you know, like Shakespearean thing. And then Kansas is like, it's like a John Ford movie. It's these wide open vistas and these sweeping shots. And like this, it's like Americana and very like, some of it reminds me of like Norman Rockwell kind of stuff. And then when you get to Metropolis, it's like an upbeat, like screwball comedy. Like all of a sudden, like the dialogue is much more snappy and people are making jokes, and you've got Otis walking around and a dog barking at him because he's trying to steal from a blind person. It's like each one, it's like three different movies, and they have different to all of them. And it's really crazy. It's really amazing the way they do that.
Yeah, that is a really excellent point. I completely agree with you that there's like three distinct segments. It's kind of ironic, you know, because I'm from New York, just like you. And you would kind of think that the Metropolis stuff, which like kind of takes place in New York, like they go past the Statue of Liberty. I think you see the World Trade Center at one point.
Right. In the movies, it is New York.
Right. So it's got that like kind of bustling feeling. And also like there's like little hints of like crime and stuff.
Yeah.
In Metropolis. It's not that sort of, you know, in more modern versions of Superman, whether it's the comics or animated shows and stuff, Metropolis is like more futuristic and has like cool technology. But in this, it's very much like New York of the 70s. And
yes, I love that.
That's the way that I was raised. That's I kind of feel the closest to that kind of sequence. But it's funny, this time around, I actually really like the Smallville stuff the best.
Mm.
And I'm not some sort of like, oh, that's where America's great, where it's all white people and farms. I think that I really like that sequence in Smallville, even though it's like the smallest sequence. Mm. It's because like the cinematography, I think, is at its best there. And I also think that like the emotional beats that they hit in the Smallville sequence are the most genuine emotional beats.
Yes, yes.
And there's very little dialogue in those scenes compared to the other two sequences. Mm. But it's just enough. I don't know. I think I always kind of remember those sequences from when I was a kid, like when he's on the Smallville farm. Yeah. Maybe when I was watching on HBO, that was the part that I always just ended up catching, you know?
Yeah. I think Richard Donner was really smart in saying, like, we need to treat Superman's story like it's American mythology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that people, maybe younger people, wouldn't understand now is that people used to think of comic books as like not art, as like something for children, as not anything important. And before Superman the movie, the biggest sort of high profile adaptation of anything would be the Adam West Batman show, mm-hmm. which was a satire. It was popular, but in itself, it was sort of making fun of superheroes and dressing up in costume and stuff. So when it came time to like write or to make the Superman movie, the first draft that was written by Mario Puzo was very jokey. And mm-hmm. Richard Donner was like, we got to take all of this out. And he said the word he used to people in the production was verisimilitude, which means like a sense of reality. Now, like the movie's in no way realistic visually or story-wise, but what I think he meant by verisimilitude was like, take it seriously. Like the stakes have to be real. It can't be winking at you. It can't be making fun of you for watching it. It can't be making fun of itself. You know, like appreciate that it's the 70s, but it came out in the late 30s. So it's at this time, it's still old and it's a big part of American life. Appreciate that people care about the character and just treat it with a lot of respect. And it's really, mm-hmm. when you think about it right now, like superheroes are such an important part of like pop culture. It's a huge swing. It's probably as much of a swing as like Christopher Nolan's Batman Begins. Mm. Of like, the point is that you take this seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And it takes its time, just like Batman Begins. Like, yeah. I don't think Superman shows up in costume until like at least an hour into the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And there is this real focus, like you said before, on each segment of Superman's personality, of his life history. You know, we spend like over 20 minutes on Krypton. There's like probably like close to 20 minutes in Smallville.
Yeah.
And then when he shows up in Metropolis, it's not just like he's flying into Metropolis and he's a superhero. It's like, right. you establish him as Clark Kent. You establish all the people in the Daily Planet office. So like everything that is a component of what Superman is fleshed out and kind of put on the table.
Yeah.
You know, before you get to him being the superhero you know, what's funny is RoboCop is another movie that I've always seen parts of, but I almost never see all the way straight through.
Yeah.
And I rewatched RoboCop because I watched this amazing documentary called RoboDoc and I covered it on the Blastercast. And it's funny because like RoboCop and Superman have a very similar,
mm-hmm.
like introduction where it's like you don't see them for over 40 minutes, and then they come in and it's like this montage of them stopping crimes and doing things.
Yeah.
And it's so dramatic in both cases, but it's like you really couldn't do better in either case.
And they're both super Christ-like figures.
Yeah, I mean,
very much so. I mean, like, you know, Jor-El putting Superman, putting Kal-El in the ship to send him to Earth is like, you know, it's like Moses, and it's, you know, we see him as a kid, and then he shows up, and he's fully formed at 30, which is like Christ in the Bible. And of course, like, RoboCop is like, Paul Verhoeven will tell you endlessly, like, it's to him, it's just a Christ story. Like, RoboCop walks on water at one point.
Well, I mean, like, in this, you know, it's funny because there aren't that many Christ images in this as you get in, like, the Zack Snyder Superman movies. Yeah. And even in Superman Returns, there's Christ-like image. But it's funny, we're talking about this right before Easter, too. But, like, in this, though, there's obviously the dynamic between Jor-El and Kal-El. And, like, there's, in the end, you know, Kal-El, you know, Superman's flying up into the clouds, and Jor-El's talking to him through the clouds. That's, like, very much like God and Jesus right there, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, but you make a really great point about the how he kind of goes away in the middle and he comes back as Superman. And I don't know, like, how we're going to do this as far as, like, if we're going in order talking about things. But with the Smallville sequence, watching it again, I really love Jeff East, who plays teenage Clark.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you have this sequence, which when I watched it again last time, I was like, that's really weird. He, like, goes away for 12 years and he's just not around. Right?
He incubates.
Yeah. Right. And he just shows up as fully formed Superman in the costume. So it's weird that there's this, like, distinct period, because they don't really do that in the comics or any other media. Like, the way they do it in the comics usually and in other media is that, like, Clark leaves Smallville and he travels the Earth and he, like, goes to different countries and stuff and kind of sees things, the way that Bruce leaves Gotham and, like, educates himself. But the idea is that, like, they leave home and they learn about the world and they come back ready to be the superhero, you know?
Right. Then now they're on their mission.
Right. Right.
So we can get into some, we don't have to go through it in order, but we can get some more, we can zoom in on some more particular things. I want to talk about how much I love the production design and the costuming on Krypton.
Mm-hmm.
It's got this, without CG, it's every costume is luminous, and it's the same way that they did Tron later on, the first Tron, and it's the same way they did the lightsabers in the first Star Wars, which is they use this material. It's the same kind of material that they use for movie screens, where when you hit it with light, it reflects light back off. So, like, if you see the behind the scenes, it looks like they're all just wearing, like, garbage made out of duct tape. Like, they look, it's looking like garbage, but when they hit it with the lights, it everything is glowing, and I love that. And one thing that always, like, disturbs me, like, even now I'm like, God, that's a harsh thing, which is when Krypton is being destroyed and you see, like, these shots of people, like, falling to their doom screaming, it's like, what a way to open a movie.
Right. There is this thing, and it's funny, this kind of brings it back to, like, what we were talking about with, like, Godzilla X Kong and Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. In movies, there's a moment when the imagery on screen, the music, the acting, they all just sync up perfectly, and it creates a sensation for everyone. And that's the stuff when you have all these movies based on nostalgia, these YouTube channels, podcasts, where people are talking about their past. It's like we're talking about those specific moments because there's something that happens in those moments that just hit us and they stick in our mind forever. Like, I will always remember the people falling in Krypton, you know, because it's such a, it's like, it's weird. It's fucking horrible.
Yeah.
You know, because, like, it's always the same story with Krypton where, like, Jor-El's trying to persuade everyone to, like, leave the planet, or we have to stop what we're doing because it's going to destroy the planet. And everyone, like, in our real fucking world is like, oh, who cares? You know, we're going to just keep going, you know?
Right. And there's a woman on Krypton who's like, I just think that Krypton is shifting in its axis.
Yes. Yeah. It's, oh, God, deniers. And so what happens is, like, they pay the price in this movie. And I think it might be the most severe in this movie than even, like, the Zack Snyder version.
Yeah.
You know?
It's dark.
Yeah. Because, like,
and it looks like hell because you've got that red light.
Right.
It's, you know, that's an interesting thing about the the Krypton part, which is like it's like all white or red or green, you know. And then you get into to Smallville, and it's like all like there's even like a soft white haze over everything, like it looks like a memory. It's all like this like Norman Rockwell like Saturday Evening Post like version of Americana, like the football team and all that shit.
Yes,
so it's just so incredible. The different movies in this one movie.
Yes. And that Krypton scene, I mean, we should definitely talk about Krypton in general and kind of flesh out a little more. But like you were talking about like biblical stuff before with Moses and Jesus, like when they're falling, it's like out of a painting from like the Renaissance or something where it's showing hell. It's like showing people literally falling into hell, you know?
Yes.
It's
so true.
Yeah. Do you think that, like, while we're talking about Krypton, like, should we bring up John Williams' score now, or should we save that for later?
No, yeah, let's bring it up.
Okay, so the John Williams score is just a fucking work of art. And, yes. I mean, this is John Williams in his prime. He's done Jaws at this point. He's done A New Hope at this point. He'll do Raiders of the Lost Ark in, like, a year or two. Just so, so good. And, you know, it's funny. I was thinking about John Williams. Doesn't it seem like when he does his scores that the music is actually like saying the names of the movie?
Yes,
you know, like Superman, right?
Yeah.
Like Star Wars, like that Bill Murray SNL skit.
That's so true, yeah.
And I always feel that when I watch Superman, it's like literally saying like up in the sky, it's Superman.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, right. And little kids would like say that. It's sort of intuitive.
Right. But
what's interesting to me is even though this is a unique score, what he does is compare it to like the theme to the TV show and the radio show. What it has in common, and then that continues up until Zack Snyder ruins it, is horns. Superman is horns. Like the original show is like, how's it go? It's like, no, fuck. Anyway, the original show is like same thing. It's like horns, and then like later on in the which I love this. The animated series, the one that's connected, the Bruce Timm one, again, it's like da da da, ba da da, so it's like this very bombastic, almost like what's his name? The da na 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 na, John Philip Sousa.
Yes,
like that kind of thing.
Yes. I mean, like John Williams does amazing stuff with horns in all of his different movies, and it has so much excitement, like. You know, before we get to Krypton, we should just talk about how the intro to the movie, it's kind of weird. And I always forget this, that like it starts out with like a narration of a kid reading a comic.
Yeah.
And even before that, there is curtains, like it's like a stage play. Yeah. And they pull back and then it shows the Daily Planet. And it's weird because like what the kid is saying about the Daily Planet doesn't really seem to match what then follows.
Right.
You know, it's just kind of like, here's a kid talking about the Daily Planet. And then now we're on this other planet. it's just weird.
No, it's weird. Yeah.
But, I mean, we can talk about the intro sequence in a second too. But after you go through this incredible intro sequence with the John Williams score, you then show Krypton, and it's amazing because like you're far away on Krypton, you're on this icy surface, and it's playing that dun 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 dun.
Yeah, they love the Krypton theme.
And like it. It starts off slow and quiet, and it feels like a 70s sci-fi movie.
Yeah.
You get closer and you get closer to that dome, and then the music just hits that crescendo once you hit that dome. I mean, that's amazing, man. That gives me chills.
There's such grandeur to the first two segments, really, both Krypton and Kansas. And then later on, it's like a lot of it's more like interiors. It's a lot of that jaunty, hey, you know, like screwball comedy stuff. But like when the sort of like dome is opening so they can capture the three criminals in that like thing, like that's like it reminds me of 2001. It's like such a huge image, and beginning with that trial, which by the way, the first line of the movie was Richard Donner trying to indicate the tone, right? Because the first line of the movie is Jor-El saying, "This is no fantasy."
Ah, nice.
And you see like the people, the heads on the screens, like guilty.
Yes.
Like it's so like, what the fuck are we watching? It's so wild.
Yeah.
And that's really a lot of that is such invention because Krypton, like that's a whole unique version of Krypton. Like you look at Krypton in the older stuff, and it's like it's just it's a totally different looking thing. It looks like very like Buck Rogers kind of shit.
Exactly, exactly. And what they do with comics for the most part is they kind of marry that Silver Age Krypton, where it does look like Flash Gordon, Buck Rogers kind of thing, and then this sort of crystalline Richard Donner version. That's kind of what the comic looks like. It's like those two together, you know. And it's funny because like with that sequence, like we know as guys that like, you know, research movies and stuff, it's like we know that's all like models and matte paintings.
Yeah.
But even when you're saying to yourself that's a model, you can still feel that kind of sense of scale when they do open up that dome, when Krypton does like collapse on itself and the people are falling. It's like you know what they're using to create those effects, but you still can like feel what you're supposed to be feeling in that moment of like, you know, this is this massive thing. The whole opening sequence, it's so funny because I try to picture being someone in the 70s going to see this, especially if you're not a comic book fan. It's really weird, right?
Yes, it is. Yes, absolutely.
I don't know how they did that effect where it has like, it looks like these two hula hoops circling the three criminals, but like that's really cool and alien looking, those the little rings that circle them. And then the faces on the screen, that's such a comic book image with these like giant faces around the three criminals. Yeah, I want to tell like a little quick story. I used to go to people's houses, people with special needs, like disabilities and stuff. I would go to their houses and help them, or I'd take them out into the community. And this one dude, he loved watching movies, and he was watching this movie, right? And we're watching this part with, you know, the three criminals and the Kryptonian people are judging them. And then Zod has his line where he's like, "You will kneel before me, and if not you, then your heirs." And the guy that I was helping, he always thought that he was saying your ass. So he's like, Superman's gonna come after your ass too. He said,
"I love it." I work with people with intellectual disabilities, and one of the people I work with lives in a group home, and one of his roommates, who's not even like he's not even my case, but I just talk to him because I go and visit there. One of his roommates has an incredible Master Universe collection of figures. So like when I go there, I'm constantly, me and this guy are like shooting the shit about like He-Man figures.
Yes.
And it's like, it's incredible. That's funny. That's some of the ways fandom really like is one of the ways that I find that I can connect with people with intellectual disabilities.
Yes. I mean, that's the thing about this movie and so many of the movies that like get mined nowadays for like legacy sequels and stuff like that, is that there's something just, regardless of your intellectual level, your political beliefs, anything like that, where you come from, there's just something in these movies that like strike you and affect you.
Yeah.
And, you know, even though Superman is a very American concept and this movie is very American, you know, you have people in other countries that love this movie, that love this character. But like just kind of flipping that, the sequence on Krypton is so weird and bizarre, and then you have like Terrence Stamp and I can't remember the other two actors that play Ursa and Non.
Non was like a mob guy. Did you ever hear interviews from him?
No,
he was like a mob enforcer who like wanted to like be in movies and like crazy shit. Look him up.
Well, he's intimidating looking. He's crazy. Yeah, yeah. You know? And so, you know, that whole sequence is weird. The Phantom Zone, like, it's not really clear what the Phantom Zone is. It's just basically like this sheet of glass that kind of sucks them up. And it's, I guess, that is the Phantom Zone. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's very different in the comics, too. But, I mean, what's weird about this is that they filmed this and Superman 2 simultaneously. Yes. Kind of like the Lord of the Rings movies. And they finished 75% of Superman 2 before Richard Donner left. And so, like, this whole sequence really just feels like it's setting up Superman 2.
Right.
It's the beginning of Superman, the movie, you know?
And it's amazing when you think about it, because, like, now, almost every franchise movie you see, there is time devoted to setting up other movies.
Yep.
Whether it be post-credit, or like I was talking about in Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, all of that shit with, like, James Acaster that you could cut right out of that movie, which is like setting up like the, I don't know, like Winston's team later on.
Right.
Like this movie, That's the only part that sets up part two. Like, you wouldn't, if you just watched it on its own, it doesn't feel incomplete. It's a whole movie to itself.
Right.
It's not like this is part one and then it's gonna, it doesn't even have a cliffhanger ending. It
nope.
ends.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It ends greatly too. And I mean, obviously, we'll get to that in a minute, but since we're kind of doing the, we kind of covered Krypton a lot, I think we should talk about that opening credit sequence. Because there's so much magic in that opening credit sequence. You have, like I said before, they show the Daily Planet, and I think it looks kind of like it's in black and white.
Yeah.
And then they cut up to the stars, and then you have that dun 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 dun. And like, if I go interact with anyone that's around our age and I just go dun 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 dun, yeah, they're gonna be like Superman, you know? Like, yeah. And just that effect that they have on the credits, where like the credits kind of swoop in.
Yeah.
And I saw this movie, I don't know, maybe like 6 or 7 years ago in the theater at the Alamo Drafthouse with my daughter. And I remember being in the theater and having that sound. And like when the credits would swoop in, like it would play that music, I was like, holy shit, right, what is going on? This is incredible.
It's that Richard Donner, his marching orders, which was like, this is important.
Yes.
Like everything, like even the first person we see is like Marlon Brando, like the most important actor of all time, like speaking in a very serious way, right? Like it's all like, this is important. This is very important. And what's funny is, and I know you'll know this, when they made the Masters of the Universe movie, they basically just stole this credit sequence.
Of course. Yeah, pretty much. And the music sounds just like it. Yeah, it's
just a bad facsimile of this music.
Yeah. And it goes on. And one thing I wanted to point out about the credits too that's interesting is that like it says Gene Hackman before it says Superman.
Yeah.
And then Christopher Reeve, I think he's not even like the second name you see. I think like you see Marlon Brando. Gene Hackman gets top billing. And then Margot Kidder, they don't even say Margot Kidder's name till like 6 or 7 fucking names in.
Really?
I'm like, what the hell? Yeah, they say all these other random actors that like I can't associate them with their character.
Right.
But like Margot Kidder is not like the third or fourth person.
It's so interesting.
Yeah,
that's that
yeah.
legal bullshit that even back then they were still doing.
Yeah.
Christopher Reeve really wasn't anybody at that point. So to get Christopher Reeve, they had to be like, well, who do you put on the poster? So that's why they spent so much money on Marlon Brando and Gene Hackman. And by the way, Gene Hackman is so brilliant in this movie. He's so funny. Some of the lines I still quote, like, Otis, take the man's cape. My lawyer will be reaching out to you about damages for the door. Like, all his shit is so funny.
My favorite thing that he does in this movie, it's not going to work on a podcast, but like, my favorite thing is when Miss Tessmacher is like, my mom lives in Sacramento or whatever he says. And then he just like looks at his watch and he does that face of like, not anymore.
Like, no, she doesn't. That.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I love it. He's so great.
Ned,
well, before we get to the last secrets, I want to say a little bit more about Smallville,
which
is my best version of Superman's Earth parents. Are they're old. They should be old as dirt. Like, as time has gone on, they make them younger and younger and sexy and hot. And the same thing happened to Aunt May, right?
Oh,
like,
yeah,
she's like hot now. Like, to me, like, I love that they are, even when they first get him as a baby, they're so old. And I have to say, like, talk about like gives me chills, like magical.
Yes.
The moment of this movie where he's the father is, he's fixing the tire. He's got the car on a jack, and then the jack falls, and it almost falls on him. And then you see baby Clark is holding up the car, and you hear the John Williams music. To me, that's such magic. Like, that's the simplest effect in the world, but that is so effective to me of wow, look at this.
Yep. Yes, exactly. Like, the thing is, you think about this movie and you think, okay, well, I saw this when I was a kid. It's kind of drilled into you when you're a kid that Superman's awesome and that there's this kind of majesty about him. But I really do think it's like Star Wars, where if you were to show this to a person, and it doesn't matter what age they are or what language they speak, there's just something in the filmmaking itself that like it just hits you. Like, that sequence is so great when he lifts up the car, you know. It's like, I was trying to think of like what are the definitive moments of this movie that I think everyone kind of remembers. Everyone remembers the opening credits and the theme.
Yeah.
They remember like Krypton and how weird it is. I think they usually remember when Superman rescues Lois. Right. And then, of course, they always remember that end sequence when he spins around the Earth.
Yes, yeah.
But the thing is, the reason why every one of these things is memorable is because everything is like set up to where it's like leading to this crescendo, and it hits that crescendo, and it is an emotional beat every single time, you know, where it hits that crescendo.
That's Francis Ford Coppola, like, says, like, you know, like, forget, like, script writing guides. Like, if you want a movie, you just need, like, 7 moments.
Yeah.
Like, that's a movie.
Yes. And this movie does have 7 fucking moments. Yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So I think we were kind of talking about Smallville and just, like, why don't we talk about, like, the actors and stuff, right?
Sure.
Okay. So, like, obviously, I think that, like, the definitive Superman is Christopher Reeve Superman, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what happens is, like, you have younger people who start to say, like, well, Henry Cavill. And then you have these weird kind of Zack Snyder cult people that feel like Henry Cavill is, like, the definitive Superman, even though I'd say, like, maybe 10% of his Superman kind of captures the Superman essence.
Right.
Whereas Christopher Reeve is, like, the walking Superman essence, you know?
Well, I would say that, and this is no offense to Christopher Reeve, but I would say what makes it so effective is the same reason I think Luke Skywalker is so effective, which is, like, there's not a ton there, and that's no disrespect to Mark Hamill. There's enough that it could be an avatar for the audience to sort of project onto.
Mm.
Like, it almost works better to not be too particular, to not be too idiosyncratic. Like, he's just, like, a handsome young man, both of them, you know what I mean? Like, something really works about that.
Mm-hmm. I feel like, I mean, that's a fucking excellent point. I didn't even think of that at all, but you're right. I feel like so much of this movie is people reacting to Superman, people interacting with Superman versus Superman's own internal dialogue or his own feelings and stuff like that, you know?
Yes.
Like when Superman first shows up, there's that montage where he's, like, saving people and he's, you know, getting criminals and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's everyone's reaction to seeing Superman. That's what that sequence is. Then when he goes with Lois, it's all about Lois's wonder of being with Superman.
Yeah.
Then when he goes to get Lex at the end, it's like Lex is just throwing everything at him.
Yeah.
And he's just kind of shrugging. But it's always, like, the reaction to what Superman is versus, like, he's having these conversations. Like, he's like, I don't know what to do with these powers. I mean, that is in this movie, but it's such a small part compared to what it is nowadays. Nowadays, it's almost like the inverse.
It's like
so much about the hero's struggles and, like, their identity, whereas it's like more like Superman as an icon that everyone's interacting with.
Yes, that's perfectly put. Like, he's not really, after the Smallville sequence, he's sort of like, his arc is over in a way. He knows what he's doing.
Yep.
It's just about meeting somebody like Lex Luthor. And I think he's so gee golly gosh, like, positive that just the idea of somebody like Lex Luthor, like, off puts him, like, somebody who could be that cruel.
And Lois is the contrast to that too, because Lois talks so quickly. She's so busy. Like, what's really interesting about the framing up the sequences with Lois is that Lois is always kind of talking, and, like, as she's talking, she's doing something else. She's, like, kind of the embodiment of, like, ADHD, where it's like she's, like, doing 5 different things at once. But Clark is always quietly just walking behind her. Like, he's, like, this calm thing, and she's just running circles around him. And she says condescending things, and he kind of says self-deprecating things and then just sort of innocent things. So there's that contrast between the two of them. But there's these two fucking sequences that are just fucking amazing with her. And people always talk about one of them all the time. But when, like, they get mugged, like, pretty quickly, and he's all scared. He's like, oh, we better do what she says, or he says, you know. And then the guy fucking shoots them, but he blocks the bullet. Oh, my God, that's so good. And then, of course, you know, the other sequence I'm talking about, when he's in Lois's apartment.
Yeah.
And he takes off the glasses and he changes his posture.
Yeah.
I mean, people cite that all the time, where they're like, that's Superman.
Right.
Or, like, that explains why people make that, where they don't connect Superman with Clark.
Right. You don't even really, right. You, when he does that, you can tell how he's actually playing them differently. That, like, his posture is different, and the way he, like, puts his chest out is different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, going back to the guy who mugs them. This movie has a lot of like really great like 70s New York stereotypes. Like that guy's like, oh, I'm gonna turn over a new leaf right after I rip this lady's purse off. Or maybe my favorite is the one who I think he's supposed to be a pimp because he's dressed like a pimp and then he's got all of these women behind him. And Superman comes out. This is when he's gonna save Lois, and he goes, "Whoa, Jim, that's a bad outfit." And then he goes, he fucking flies, and he goes, "Whoa, again." I love that.
Yeah, that's the first time we see Superman, and right before he flies, the pimp guy says that. Yeah,
yeah,
it's so great.
Awesome, Jim. That's so great. Or the cops, like, go on down to Murphy's Bar and finish what you're doing.
Oh, right, right. Man.
You know, like good old fashioned alcoholic Irish cops.
Yes, yes, yes. Oh man, I love that sequence so much. It's so fucking good. And like one of my favorite parts is when the guy is climbing up the side of the building with the suction cups.
Oh yeah.
And you take a couple of minutes to like establish, okay, this guy is climbing up the side of the building. It's difficult. And then you have this great shot where like it's just Superman's feet against the window.
Yeah.
And then you look up and he's like, the elevator broken? He says something like that.
All of that and shit. So,
so fucking good.
The guy hits him with a
crowbar.
Yeah,
crowbar.
And he's like, bad vibrations. I love that. I love all that corny shit.
Yeah. It's funny with that sequence. I'm like, wait a minute. It's like Superman really helping in that one particular spot because he takes their boat and he just puts it like right in the middle of downtown.
Such issues.
Yeah. Can we talk about that sequence with the helicopter, though, and Margot Kidder?
Sure.
So one thing I noticed watching this movie more recently is that, like, Margot Kidder has at least two scenes of, like, total distress where she's, like, screaming. And in both instances, it seems like a fucking horror movie.
Yeah.
And it's funny because she was in Black Christmas, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But, like, in this movie, there's scenes where she looks like she's just, like, scared out of her fucking mind.
Yeah.
Right? And one of them is that helicopter sequence that is so well done.
Yes.
With the helicopter like spinning around and it's like smashing parts of the building and then it falls off the building. She's literally hanging from the helicopter at one point.
Yeah.
And then Superman catches her. I think that like just Margot Kidder deserves some of our praise just for like how scared she seems in those two sequences.
Right. She sells it.
Oh,
she
yeah.
She sells it. But I think she also talking, going back to what we were saying before about how this movie establishes things going forward in the Superman story. I think she's the one who really makes Lois like funny and sharp witted and sharp tongued. Mm-hmm. And like, I feel like every Lois after this is like this sort of like second wave feminist Lois who's like super on top of everything, not afraid to like talk to the boss.
Yeah.
Like, so like, basically, like, if you look at like the old TV show, like Clark is like a more respected reporter than her. And in this and moving forward in the Lois and Clark dynamic, Lois is always the one with the power.
Oh,
whereas
yeah.
in the Superman Lois dynamic, Superman's the one with the power, which creates this triangle.
Yes.
Like, I feel like that's, she brings all of that to the character.
Yes, 1000%. Like Margot Kidder's Lois is like the template for Lois moving forward. And like in the comics, and I mean, even in the animated stuff too, but in the comics, definitely, Lois is usually like the greatest reporter on the planet.
Yeah, she's
the greatest reporter ever. And yeah, she's always like two steps ahead of everybody else, including Clark. You hit the nail on the head there. She's like her attitude and stuff, that's the Lois moving forward from here.
Yeah. Well, so you said let's talk about the actors. Some of the other performances are really good.
Oh, hell yeah.
You've got Mark McClure as Jimmy Olsen. His other big thing was he was Marty McFly's older brother, Dave McFly. I love Ned Beatty as Otis.
Yes.
All of that stuff could be corny, but somehow like it all works so well in this.
Yeah.
You know, I love like Otis Berg.
Yes.
Yes. Jackie Cooper as Mr. White, I love.
Yes.
So many of his lines, like I think are so quotable. Like, don't call me sugar, or Clark Kent may seem like a mild-mannered reporter. Not only does he know how to treat his editor-in-chief with proper respect, not only does he have a snappy prose style, but he is, in my 40 years in this business, the fastest typist I have ever seen.
Right, like, right.
That dialogue is so funny. Like when he's got them all in the room and he's like, does he have a girlfriend? What's his favorite ball team? And then Clark goes to answer, which is such a quick joke. I didn't even notice that joke when I was a kid.
Yeah.
He steps up in the secretary's right there and she's like, okay, chief. Like I just love everything about him.
It's funny because like with Perry White, you have pretty iconic actors playing him afterwards too, right? Like in Superman Returns, it's kind of funny because you mentioned, the Masters of the Universe movie, but like Frank Langella is Perry White in Superman Returns, right? So you get like a little bit of full circle, right? Because that's also like the Cannon guys did Superman 4. But you know, he's Perry White. And I think he's really good in that too. Then you have Lawrence Fishburne who plays him in the Zack Snyder movies too. So yeah, but this is kind of like the definitive Perry White too, where he's always busy. And yeah, I love him too. I've never seen that actor in other movies. Is he in other stuff too?
He's in other stuff. I've been watching all of Columbo. I actually just watched an episode of Columbo where he was the killer.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
He was like a political, he was like running for mayor or something. And he like killed his campaign manager. It was a good one. That was actually a few years before this. But yeah, he's like a comedic actor. He's so with the cigar and everything. Like I feel like J. Jonah Jameson gets a lot from his performance of Mr. White.
Right. Those are examples of like DC and Marvel characters where they're essentially like parallels to each other.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the Flash and Quicksilver or like Namor and Aquaman. Yeah. Like, yeah, it's like those two are like the two. And the Daily Bugle and the Daily Planet are like the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But Spider-Man is the Jimmy Olsen, right? Versus
exactly. Clark Kent. Right, right. I want to mention her because I think she's great. Valerie Perrin as Miss Tessmacher.
Absolutely.
She did not do a lot. She was a Playboy playmate.
Oh yes.
So she was like known as this beautiful figure. I think she's so funny in this.
Yes.
She's still alive. She's in her 80s. She sadly has Parkinson's disease.
Oh.
And somebody did a documentary of her a couple years ago. She only was in like a handful of movies. And her other big thing besides this was she was in the movie Lenny, playing Lenny Bruce's wife.
Oh, okay. Wow.
But this is like, I always think of her as like Miss Tessmacher. And like,
yes,
I
of course.
Miss Tessmacher, it's such a good foil to Gene Hackman.
Yes. I noticed something weird this time. There's this one sequence when like Lex gets pissed off, I think because they mess up something with the nukes. I can't remember what it is. But like, he calls Miss Tessmacher and like she runs into the room and Ned Betty runs into the room and they kind of run in together and they both look flustered. And like, she kind of like goes like this with her mouth, like she like kind of wipes her mouth and then like Ned Betty's kind of like adjusting his clothes. And I was like, is that implying that they were like making out or doing something? Like,
wow, Lex's back. Wow,
yeah.
I never even caught that.
Yeah. 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 Rewatch and see what you think, you know?
One thing that I kind of like, but younger people, it doesn't hold up. I showed this in a class and a lot of the young kids were like, that's not good. But I love that she kisses Superman before letting him free.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my younger, the students were like, well, that's not consent, which I understand. But there's something something I like about it. I like how easily she swayed to the good side just by how good he is.
Yes.
She kisses him because I didn't think you'd let me later.
Right, right. Well, I like that sequence because she also makes him promise to rescue her mother first, right? I didn't remember.
Never
that
lie. You never lie. Promise you because you never lie.
Yeah. Well, and see, like that's one thing that brings up another point I wanted to make too. It's interesting because like Superman has that montage where he does a whole bunch of things, and then essentially you just go right to Lex's scheme, right?
Right.
And but between that montage and Lex's scheme, it seems like Superman becomes like a big part of the culture. Like the fact that she says you never lie. I mean, Lois's article obviously gives a lot of information away.
Yeah.
But like people like recognize him immediately and stuff like that afterwards. You know, it's like he's just become part of the fixture by this point.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
there are things that we should talk about that are like they don't really kind of they don't hold up as much, right? Like the sequence where Lois interviews him. That's a great sequence. The flying sequence is great. But that's where it seems like the most awkward, when they're like flying together and like she's struggling, you know. And then also there's, of course, like the infamous like poem that Lois is saying to herself.
So originally that was supposed to be a song.
That
but
makes
she
sense.
Couldn't sing, so they made it a poem. So it's really, it's, you know, with contemporary filmmaking, you never see anything like that. So it seems so corny to us.
Right.
The only thing I would say in terms of defending it is that, you know, as you know, a big part of the medium of comics is interior monologue.
Yes.
And it's a one section of this film where you get an interior monologue.
Yeah.
But the fact that it still rhymes like the way the song would rhyme almost makes it worse. Like,
yes.
Like you could keep it, but I would cut out certain things.
Yes.
But that's this. See, that seems, I think, important because, and that's what I used to show in the class where I taught about gender, because I would talk about how, like, Superman is established not only as a man, but as heterosexual in that scene, because she says, what color my underwear? And he can't see it because she's in front of the lead. And then she walks back and he goes, pink.
Pink.
And then she goes, do you like pink? What does that mean? And I would ask my students and they would giggle. I go, what does she mean when she says, do you like pink? And then he says, I like pink very much, Lois. Right?
Yeah.
It's like, are you straight? Or do you or do you fuck? Like, because
it's
she
like,
also asked him, do
pussy?
You eat? Right, exactly. She asks, like, do you eat? Do you, you know what I mean? Like, she wants to see, like, if he's human or not. And of course, Lex, like, he has no hair, so he's not a man. And in it's not in this one, but in part two, there's a joke about Lex listening to Liberace records. So it seems like like Lex is not, like, Superman is a man, and part of being a man is being straight and loving vagina. And,
and
Lex Luthor is his opposite, because he's not a man and he's not straight and he's a little gay. And I'm not taking the movie to task. It's just a way of looking at, using this as a lens of looking at how culture depicts sexuality and gender.
Sure. Well, I mean, that's really interesting, because I mean, like, with Miss Tessmacher, there really isn't the implication that, like, Lex does anything with her, or like he's like having sex with her. As a matter of fact, what I just said before, it almost seems like her and Otis are getting it on the side, right? But he kind of uses her like a tool, the way that he uses Otis, where it's like, go do this, go do that.
Right.
Versus like, oh, I got this hot chick with me, you know.
Right. There's no implication that they have a relationship that is in any way romantic.
Yeah, that's really interesting that you bring up that one part for gender discussions, you know, because it's a weird scene too, because like, it's the most sexual thing in the whole movie.
Right.
And it seems like they're totally okay with it. And then there really isn't any kind of other sexual stuff. There's a couple of times where, like, women are, like, impressed with Superman. Like, Miss Tessmacher talks about how good-looking he is. She mentions his dimples and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think some other people kind of, like, lust over Superman. But, like, that's it.
Right. And in that scene, Lois also goes, how big are you? And then corrects herself and goes, how tall are you? Like, it's real direct stuff. And it's an interview, but she's dressed in this.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Her outfits are great. I love all of Lois's outfits.
Yes.
And what she's wearing there is like this flowy thing. It looks like almost like lingerie.
Yes, yes.
And I love the outfit later on when he rescues her. She's wearing like a yellow beret and like a yellow jacket. And I guess I wasn't paying attention enough, but I noticed when I watched it yesterday, he realizes that she is in trouble because her beret falls out of the helicopter and Clark picks it up outside of the Daily Planet, and that's when he looks up.
That's fucking awesome. Yeah. With him and her, it's so funny because, like, there's that dynamic that, like, Clark is one distinct guy. She doesn't know that that's Superman, right? There's Clark and there's Superman. And we've already kind of talked about this today, but, like, it's this weird sequence where he takes her flying, and it's almost like the equivalent of, like, this macho guy goes and has a ton of sex with her, and she's still, like, thinking about him. Then this goofy guy comes in and he's like, oh, I'm going to treat you to the night on the town. We're going to have some burgers, right? And she's like so like stunned and shocked after flying with Superman that like she's kind of saying gibberish and she's not even paying attention to Clark.
Yeah.
She says, I'll go get my coat. She doesn't get her coat. And going back to what you're saying about like her outfits, I was like, wait a minute, she's going on a date with Clark wearing that? Like, it looks like she's wearing Victoria's Secret or something.
Yeah.
But there's such a distinct difference between like Clark and Superman.
Yeah.
That like he's like the sort of the cuck or something, you know, that takes
out of the date. It's like, yeah, like he gets off on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, like yeah, tell me how much you like Superman while we're
right. He's like drinking his shake at the burger place and he's like, oh, did he hold you tightly? You know, like something like yeah. As you were flying, you saw that bird.
I mean, you're right. It's so sexual. Like when she's like, Clark says something about like Peter Pan or whatever. And he's like, Peter Pan. He flew with children, Lois. it's so. But it's funny that also those things become archetypes in the Superman story. Mm-hmm, like I'm a big fan of the new show. My Adventures with Superman.
Oh yes, yeah, okay. Yeah,
the
yeah.
anime mm-hmm. show. And they do that in that one. There's the date first interview. Like she gives him his name mm-hmm. and she introduces him to the world through that interview. Like these are like little like beats that you have to always hit.
Yes, yeah. Lois pretty much has to come up with the name of Superman herself.
Yeah, yeah. Let me ask you, is this the best Superman movie?
Oh, that's a loaded question. Yes, I would say it is the best Superman movie. I would not say it's my favorite. I think Superman 2 is my favorite.
Because
I like all the stuff with Zod and the Kryptonians. But I think this is the best Superman movie. Well, what about you? What do you think, man?
Definitely Batman versus Superman.
No,
I'm just fucking around. No, yeah. I would say this is, I think it's the best, and I do think it's my favorite. But two is great, and two is like a perfect way to make a sequel. But like now let's like you really get into it.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, to me, what blows my mind is like I feel like Superman is so it's such a good character. Like people mock Superman and people say like, oh, how can you if he's so strong? How do you even write stories? It's like, well, your question doesn't make sense because we've been writing stories for 70 years. Like obviously we do. I feel like. This movie part two and a little bit Superman Returns, although that's very flawed, I at least get close, but I feel like there could be better Superman movies. So I feel like here's the thing, as much as I love this movie, I feel like you have to divorce yourself from a lot of what this movie does and just say like, all right, I'm not going to use the theme, I'm not going to use some of this stuff. And you know, Zack Snyder went a whole bad, terrible direction with it. But there's so much you can do, and you know, maybe like don't use Lex. Say we're not going to use Lex. We're going to use somebody different.
Right.
It blows my mind that there aren't a bunch more really good Superman movies because there could be. Because mm-hmm. there's good Superman shows. Like I said, the '90s animated series is such a perfect example of like how to do a Superman show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny because Batman. I mean, I can't even like you know it'll take up a lot of time if I try to count every movie that Batman is in. But there's way more Batman movies than there are Superman movies.
And way more good Batman movies.
Way more good Batman movies. And then there's so much more of the rogues gallery that's been used besides the Joker, even though the Joker's used a lot, right? But then you always just have Lex. Sometimes you have Zod. Everyone always thinks there's going to be a Brainiac movie, but there hasn't been one yet.
No.
And of course, these characters are used in video games. They're used in comic books and cartoons all the time. Like you see Brainiac all the time, and other guys. You see Doomsday and stuff, right? Sometimes, but it's so funny that we're having this conversation right now because, like, at this moment, they are filming another Superman, and it's literally just Superman. One. Yeah, because it was called Superman Legacy, but now they've changed it to just Superman. You know,
I have high hopes for it. I like James Gunn. I've liked his movies. I mean, of all his movies, the only one I really don't like is the second Guardians, but I love the first ones. I love the third one. Yeah. I like a lot of his stuff. I liked Peacemaker. So I have hopes for it. I have a lot of hopes for it.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of funny. This kind of gives some symmetry, like, you know, bookends, but like the beginning of our discussion was about how I feel like a lot of these like legacy sequels, these reboots, they're kind of missing some kind of quality that makes you feel something, that wonder or that just that feeling, that connection. And when I was watching Kong, Godzilla X Kong, I was like, oh, in the Guardians movies, that's where I would feel this kind of like wonder and connection.
Yeah.
Like he can tap into that. In Peacemaker, there's moments where it's like he gets it. Like it's like this is how you sync up the imagery and the music. Like James Gunn gets it. He doesn't get it perfectly every single time, but he does it a lot better than most people that make comic book adaptations.
So you just made me think James Gunn would be would do a great Ghostbusters movie, I think.
Oh my God.
Because I mean, James Gunn is actually funny. Like he gets comedy, which is why I think Guardians works so well.
Right. And you know that he wrote like the Scooby-Doo movies and stuff, right? So he's kind of got experience.
Oh, yeah.
He's got experience like kind of working with like kid connected things. I mean, that's a whole discussion for another day too, like Ghostbusters and kids and stuff.
Yeah.
But Lex is in this new Superman movie. You know, James Holt, or is it Nicholas Holt? Nicholas Holt, right?
Oh, I didn't realize he was Lex.
He's Lex, yeah. Michael Rosenbaum from Smallville just interviewed him recently, and they were talking about playing Lex. And it's funny, bringing it back to our discussion, Nicholas Holt, he said that he didn't really study other Lexes. And then Michael Rosenbaum said, you know, Michael Rosenbaum, who played Lex on Smallville, he's like, I consider Gene Hackman to be the definitive Lex, you know?
Interesting, because I feel like his performance is so different from Gene Hackman's.
Yeah, well, right. Gene Hackman's Lex, the only other Lex in modern media that's like Gene Hackman's Lex is Kevin Spacey's Lex. And that's because Kevin Spacey's Lex literally is Gene Hackman's Lex continued.
Right.
But even Kevin Spacey's Lex is much more sinister, you know, than the Gene Hackman Lex.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
I mean, fucking like Shiv Superman with kryptonite at the end of that movie. Yeah. Right. Yeah. But like Lex is such an interesting character. Like if you were asking me like what do I think is like the best Superman adaptation, I would actually say it's the Tim verse Superman, because that's where it's like firing on all cylinders. It's where you have Clancy Brown as Lex, and it's that version of Lex, you know, and he interacts with Batman and stuff like that. Like I would say that that's kind of like the definitive.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And we haven't mentioned, well, you just did, but we haven't really talked about Smallville. I liked Smallville, you know, towards, I mean, it went on too long, but I liked Smallville. And I don't think you've checked it out yet, but check out the anime. Check out My Adventures with Superman. Yeah. I like that a lot.
Okay.
There's so much good stuff to do with Superman. Part of me is like, let's do it. There's so much there.
Yeah, it's weird because there always is this dynamic of like that the movie is like the pinnacle of what you can do with media. That like once you get to a movie, because it costs so much money and so many people are going to see it, that like that's the highest standard is the movie.
But Superman works as a serial, which is what comics are. Like Superman works better as a that's why probably the most faithful, let's say, adaptation is the animated series.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Like Superman, more so than Batman and stuff, like you kind of associate Superman with like listening to him on the radio.
Yeah.
And then of course, like even the old show with George Reeves, right? That was the show. And then there was also like the cartoon that was the Fleischer cartoon, which is
those are so good.
So like Superman does work more in like a serialized kind of small adventures versus like this big definitive story. Yeah. Like Batman has like definitive Batman stories that maybe were told in a serialized form, but it's like, okay, the Killing Joke and Year One.
Yeah, that's true.
Like Superman does have stories like that, but they don't resonate as much as Batman stories.
No, you're totally right.
Yeah.
Well, Pete, thank you so much for coming on and talking about Superman the movie. I'm so glad I did this with you, and you were able to bring your vast knowledge. What's going on your channels? What's going on in your world?
Well, for like the six people that listen to my show or watch it, I really appreciate them. But no, I have one channel called Comic Books Transformed. If you like my stuff talking about if you like how I talked about Superman today, then you'll probably like Comic Books Transformed. Brian and I right now currently are covering Invincible, which is on Amazon Prime. And then we are covering X-Men 97 on Disney Plus. So we're covering some animated stuff.
How is that? I
think it's fucking fantastic.
Oh, really?
That's awesome. Yeah. I love it. And you can check out our videos too if you want to kind of get my thoughts on it. And then like on the LasserCast, Danny and I, we cover horror movies and streaming shows. Recently, we did a Dario Argento run where yes, we were covering. Yes, I saw that. Yeah. And
did you like Tiambre?
I've loved every single Argento film I've seen. And the thing is that I've never watched an Argento movie until this year.
Oh, wow.
But yeah.
What's great about Italian movies are they'll be like, oh, this is a great story. How do we get boobs into this?
Right.
That's Italian movies.
Right. And can a dog bite one of the nipples too? You know?
Yes.
Yeah. No, but I've loved those Argento films, and we've been covering them on the channel. But then we did cover Ghostbusters, Frozen Empire. My review is a little bit more harsh than Mike's, if you want to check out mine. And then tomorrow, Danny and I, for Easter, we're going to record Godzilla X Kong. So we're going to do our review tomorrow.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very good. Pete, thank you so much for being here. We end every episode by saying,
go bye-bye.